Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Right now, where we're sitting, we're pretty happy with the results. But again, this is just the primary.
Alaskans went to the polls yesterday. The early results are in, and we've got them. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, August 17th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, environmentalists say king salmon fishing hurts killer whales in Puget Sound, but fishermen disagree.
Less than 2% of the king salmon we catch are from Puget Sound. That's fish nerds speak for none.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Pacific University offers an education as an adventure in living and learning. Students are the core of APU, representing the aspirations and collective wisdom of our community. Education is collaborative, innovative, and transformational, encouraging student development and honoring Alaska's Indigenous heritage while offering a unique and powerful educational experience. Learn more at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Senator Lisa Murkowski has widened her primary lead over challenger Kelly Chewbacca with nearly all precincts reporting. Murkowski now has 44% of ballots cast, while Chewbacca is at 40%. Both Murkowski and Chewbacca will move forward to the general election on November 8th. In this pick one primary, the top 4 vote-getters in each race advance to the general. On Wednesday, Murkowski's campaign said results showed clear and strong momentum for Alaska's senior senator. In the race for governor, early results have Governor Mike Dunleavy leading the primary with 42% of the vote. Independent former Governor Bill Walker and Democratic former state legislator Les Guerra are about 20 points behind Dunleavy. Republican Kenai Peninsula Borough Mayor Charlie Pierce is a distant fourth place. Late Tuesday night, Dunleavy said he's looking ahead to campaigning for the November general election.
Right now, where we're sitting, we're pretty happy with the results. But again, this is just the primary, and the real race starts here tomorrow.
Meanwhile, in the ranked choice special election for U.S. House, Democrat Mary Peltola maintained a slight lead at 38% of first place votes. Former Governor Sarah Palin followed at 32%, and fellow Republican Nick Begich III came in third at 29%. Peltola was expected to finish ahead in the three-way race, with only first-choice votes counted on election night. The two Republicans are splitting the conservative vote. If Palin's second-place standing holds, Begich will be eliminated, and if enough of his voters ranked Palin as a second choice, Palin could overtake Peltola's lead and win the seat. The ultimate result of the special election won't be clear until at least August 31st. The state expects to certify final primary results in early September. Whoever wins the special election will be sworn in next month to serve the remainder of the late Congressman Don Young's term until January. Turnout among registered voters on Tuesday was just over 26%, the highest in a primary election since 2014. Here for some post-election analysis is Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin. Liz, the big race everyone was watching was the special election. Again, that's the one to fill the remaining months of Congressman Don Young's term. Democrat Mary Peltola was the top vote getter, but does she actually have a chance at winning the seat?
Yeah, she does. But the real story, if you ask me, is that Sarah Palin is ahead of Nick Begich. If that order holds, it is his ballots that would be redistributed. His voters' second rankings, they're not all going to go to his fellow Republican, but a lot of them are likely to go to Palin. Peltola is now 6 percentage points ahead of Palin. It's not clear that's enough of a lead to overcome those second votes. Now, overnight, Peltola gained a teeny bit. She crested 38%, while Palin and Begich went down a little bit, but we're talking a fraction of a percentage point. If that trend continues with the late arriving ballots, you know, it might be close between Peltola and Palin.
So is it actually clear at this point that Begich finished in third and is really out of the running?
Oh, not at all. He's about 3 points behind Palin. Again, that gap closed a teeny bit overnight. So it's possible that Palin finishes third and it's her second rankings that would get redistributed. But the way things are looking now, Sarah Palin is probably on track to be Alaska's next member of Congress. And, you know, ranked choice voting was supposed to favor consensus candidates and moderates. And instead, wouldn't it be ironic if RCV is what brings us to Congresswoman Sarah Palin?
Yeah. So again, that's for the short term, just until the end of this year. Is it possible that one candidate wins the special U.S. House race and another wins the general November election for the next term?
It is possible. That's something Mary Peltola is saying. She says Democrats, progressives, fishermen, other people, you know, inclined to vote for her, don't tend to turn out as often for elections in August, though they may show up in bigger numbers in November. She says she could do better in the regular general election for the next term. But on the other hand, someone is going to be the Congress member for the next few months. That person will have an office, a title, will look like a Congress member, will be making connections, raising money. That person is really going to have a leg up.
So let's talk about the U.S. Senate race. I know you've been following this one closely. It looks like Lisa Murkowski and Kelly Chewbacca were pretty close.
Well, the latest I saw from today shows Murkowski at 44% and Chewbacca at just under 40%. So, you know, that is a gap. Let's remember, though, that Tuesday was a primary for U.S. Senate. Murkowski, Chewbacca, along with Democrat Pat Chesbro, who got 6%, and a fourth candidate are likely to go on to the November ballot. So that gap between those two, it's more of a indicator than a determinative factor.
Well, tell me about that fourth candidate, because that was kind of a mystery as far as who was going to be joining Murkowski, Chewbacca, and Chesbro in the general ballot.
Yeah, it's somebody named Buzz Kelly. We don't know much about him. He's a Republican. I have to wonder if he didn't get some votes because his last name is Kelly, and Chewbacca's campaign sign said Kelly for Alaska. He got about 3,400 ballots, not a ton, but, you know, that might have happened.
So he'll be moving on. But when will we know who wins the special election for U.S. House? When do we get to find out?
Not until the end of the month. And that's because by state law, mailed ballots in the general have 15 days to arrive at the Division of Elections. Normally, we don't really pay much attention to that because, you know, it's pretty clear a few days after the election who's won. But in this case, the division will not determine who finished third until then. And that's when they start the redistribution based on elimination rounds.
Gotcha. All right. That was Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin. You can read more of her reporting and our team that was covering the election at alaskapublic.org/elections. Liz, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Casey.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a small village in Bristol Bay gets statewide recognition for its library.
We're surprised and delighted, and it fuels the fire for going forward.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
NEA Alaska is a professional education association representing over 11,000 of Alaska's dedicated public school employees. Their members are united in their commitment to provide an excellent education for every student, regardless of background or zip code. Together, NEA Alaska members work with colleagues, parents, and their communities to build strong public schools that are productive, safe, and welcoming to all. Learn more at neaalaska.org. This message sponsored by NEA Alaska.
Two oil and gas companies have announced plans to invest $2.6 billion into developing a major oil field on Alaska's North Slope. The Anchorage Daily News reports that Australia-based Santos and Spain-based Repsol made the announcement Tuesday. Santos has a 51% stake in the Pica project, and the company says its investment will be $1.3 billion. Santos last year acquired Oil Search of Papua New Guinea, which had been working to advance the project. If developed, the field on state land east of the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, could significantly boost the flow of oil through the Trans-Alaska pipeline system. A federal judge in Seattle has ruled that the National Marine Fisheries Service violated a key provision of the Endangered Species Act when they published research on the harvest of king salmon in southeast Alaska and failed to address its impact on killer whales in Puget Sound. U.S. District Court Judge Richard A. Jones on August 8th ordered that an appropriate remedy be found. While it possibly could limit commercial trolling for Chinook and Southeast, it will more likely result in a rewrite of the biological opinion that led to the problem. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
U.S. District Court Judge Richard Jones on August 8th granted summary judgment to the plaintiff, the Washington-based Wild Fish Conservancy. The headlines that caromed around the internet spelled doom for commercial salmon trawlers in southeast Alaska.
I think we've won the recognition that this fishery was actually causing harm to threatened and endangered species and, for all intents and purposes, was illegal.
Kurt Beardsley is the director of special projects for the Conservancy and has been the driving force behind the lawsuit since its inception. The Wild Fish Conservancy filed suit against the National Marine Fisheries Service in March of 2020, arguing the government failed to adequately address the impact of Alaskan king salmon harvests on southern resident killer whales, whose population in the Puget Sound area of Washington has dropped to critically low levels. The statistic that the Wild Fish Conservancy repeats most is that 97% of king salmon harvested by southeast Alaska trawlers don't originate in Alaska, depriving southern resident killer whales of their primary food source. Matt Donahoe is president of the Alaska Trollers Association.
The Alaska Technical Committee says that less than 2% of the king salmon we catch are from Puget Sound. That's fish nerd speak for none.
The ATA intervened in the suit along with the state of Alaska. Donahoe trolls for kings in a fishery that's meticulously renegotiated with Canada every decade in a document called the Pacific Salmon Treaty. Southeast Alaska's trollers have taken steep reductions in their harvest allocations in the last two treaty rounds in the name of conserving stocks. Donahoe says the Wild Fish Conservancy lawsuit unjustly characterizes Southeast trollers as intercepting fish they're not entitled to.
They're from Southeast Alaska, British Columbia, Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. That's all regulated by the Pacific Salmon Treaty. Those fish spend most of their lives in Southeast Alaska waters.
Donahoe says it's unfair that Southeast trollers have been singled out in the lawsuit when, in his view, there are far more significant factors at play in the decline of this small population of killer whales: the rapid urbanization of the Puget Sound area, industrial pollutants in the water, large-scale whale watching, hydroelectric projects. Kurt Beardsley with the Wild Fish Conservancy agrees nothing is the only problem. But he doesn't want to let trollers off the hook just because the other problems aren't as well understood.
Everybody also wants to point to something else if they happen to get in the crosshairs.
The state of Alaska tilts more toward Donahoe's view that it's wrong to pin the decline of endangered species in Puget Sound on the harvest of healthy fish stocks in Alaska. This is where the lawsuit will likely lead, not to a shutdown of trolling in Alaska, but to a better understanding of what's brought the population of southern resident killer whales, now thought to have around 75 members, to near extinction. Alaska Trollers Association President Matt Donahoe says he's got data indicating that closing the southeast king salmon troll fishery would accomplish nothing for the remaining southern resident killer whales. Again, he says these are not the fish the whales are eating.
It's just really discouraging. With all the problems we have in the world, you create problems like this.
Kurt Beardsley and the Conservancy want to see king salmon management overhauled and wouldn't mind returning to an earlier era when fish were harvested near their rivers of origin. This is a conversation he thinks they should be having when the U.S. and Canada next sit down to renegotiate the salmon treaty.
I think they've been too focused on allocating extraction and less focused on recovery.
In the meantime, although Judge Jones has granted summary judgment to the Wild Fish Conservancy, the case is far from over. The ruling steers the litigation in a new direction, and all parties now will submit briefs on a remedy that complies with the Endangered Species Act and preserves the Southeast Alaska troll fleet, king salmon, and the community of 75 killer whales that depends on them. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Alaska's highest court said fisheries managers did not have to manage the Cook Inlet set net fishery to national standards and that they didn't violate any regulations when they closed the fishery early. That opinion from the Alaska Supreme Court published Friday is the latest legal blow to the 440 or so Eastside permit holders who have seen their fishery close early for the last four summers due to paired restrictions with the king salmon sport fishery. Setnetters, represented by the Cook Inlet Fishermen's Fund, sued the state after the 2019 closure, alleging state restrictions on the commercial fishermen were unscientific and arbitrary and flew in the face of national standards. The Kenai Court said because there was no federal management plan for Cook Inlet fisheries at that time, the state was not bound by those standards, and it said the state's Board of Fish and Department of Fish and Game had the discretion to write and enforce their own rules. The Supreme Court justices doubled down on that opinion last week. John McCombs, president of the Fisherman's Fund, said he isn't surprised that the Supreme Court affirmed the earlier decision.
Federal management occurs in the Gulf and other fisheries, and they've just chosen to do it differently in Cook Inlet.
It's the second court defeat for the Cook Inlet Fisherman's Fund this month. The Kenai Superior Court also rejected a request from the nonprofit to immediately reopen their fishery in response to this year's fishery closure. Setnetters have taken their complaints outside the court, too. At a meeting in Soldotna earlier this month, they asked Alaska Fish and Game Commissioner Doug Vincent Lang to use his authority to partially reopen their fishery. But repeatedly, Vincent Lang told the fishermen those decisions are up to the Board of Fish.
The issues that we're all talking about around this table have been debated at length at the board. I got clear guidance. If you want that guidance changed, go to the board.
Fishermen were hopeful an out-of-cycle proposal to the Board of Fish could loosen restrictions on their fleet this summer ahead of the next board meeting in 2024. That proposal failed in a close vote in April. The telecommunications company GCI is in the process of laying hundreds of miles of subsea fiber optic cable up the Aleutian chain. The expansion of service will link parts of rural Alaska from Unalaska to Kodiak Island with high-speed internet. And as KMXT's Kirsten Dobroth reports, Kodiak is a hub for the project.
Under the sea, there's a massive web of fiber that connects communities around the globe to the World Wide Web via high-speed internet. In Alaska, that fiber zigzags on the ocean floor around southeast. And further north in the Gulf of Alaska, a separate line comes down from Homer and dead ends at Kodiak Island. At least it used to. Late last month, communications company GCI started laying 800 miles of fiber from Unalaska up the Aleutian chain with the goal of connecting six additional communities, including Larsen Bay on Kodiak Island, to high-speed internet by 2024.
It's a huge project for us and for the state of Alaska.
That's GCI Rural Affairs Director Jen Nelson. The undertaking is called the AU Aleutians Fiber Project, and Nelson says Kodiak is an important piece of the puzzle. While one ship makes its way at 2 miles per hour laying fiber up the Alaskan Peninsula, another vessel, the IT Integrity, was off Kodiak's Mill Bay Beach last week, hooking up another 80 miles of fiber that will eventually stretch from the city to the village of Larsen Bay.
So it's extending from the infrastructure that is currently in Kodiak. So that is home base for this project.
The massive project involves both laying new fiber and clearing out old debris on the seafloor. Nelson says GCI has pulled up long-abandoned fishing equipment and a telegraph line from 1908 as part of the cleanup. Residents in Larsen Bay will have to wait until 2024 for their new internet services to start, but they might not be the last Kodiak community to benefit from the project. Nelson says the villages of Port Lions and Yuzinki have both applied for grants to hook into the new fiber network, although there's currently no timeline on if and when they'll be added to the project. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobrath.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Air Cargo, serving the commerce and business needs of 20 Alaska communities, from Adak to Barrow to Ketchikan. More information at alaskacargo.com. Everyone knows eating fruits and veggies promotes a long and healthy life. It's important to make every bite count. Alaskans are lucky to have greens and berries from the land, as well as fresh, frozen, and canned. When it comes to living a long and healthy life, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by USDA SNAP Ed.
Five fighter jets from Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson intercepted Russian reconnaissance planes three times last week in airspace around Alaska. That's happened often in recent years, but a Fairbanks-based military expert says it's noteworthy that this time it occurred while the United States is helping Ukraine defend itself from Russian invaders. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
J-Bear-based F-22 fighters scrambled on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday last week to intercept a Russian IL-20 that had entered the Alaskan Air Defense Identification Zone, or ADIZ. That's international airspace, and it's not unusual for a nation to send fighters out to meet foreign aircraft that enter their ADIZ, and often to accompany them until they leave it.
On average, we conduct about 6 to 7 intercepts a year.
Captain Lauren Ott is a spokesperson for the North American Aerospace Defense Command's Alaskan region, based at J-Bear, and she says the number of intercepts has varied annually since Russia resumed its so-called out-of-area long-range aviation activity 15 years ago.
Some years as high as 14, and some years as low as 0.
This year, however, the usual game of cat and mouse is playing out in an entirely different context, one in which the United States and Russia aren't at war, but certainly at odds because of the U.S.'s leading role in supporting Ukraine in its fight against Russia's invasion. But Ott says that didn't affect last week's otherwise routine interceptions of the Russian planes near Alaska.
The recent activity by the Russian aircraft in the Alaskan ADIZ is not perceived as a threat, nor is the activity seen as provocative.
I think it is notable.
Troy Buffard is a 22-year Army veteran who now directs the University of Alaska Fairbanks' Center for Arctic Security and Resilience. He says the timing of the Russian sorties is notable because they likely were intended to send a message to the United States and its allies.
Russia is trying to demonstrate that it can still project power in different areas, even being decisively engaged in Ukraine.
Buffard says it's also no coincidence that the Russians decided now is a good time to resume the flights around Alaska because the IL-20 is equipped for intelligence, signals, and reconnaissance, or ISR missions, and he suspects they were interested in listening in on radio communications between U.S. and allied forces engaged in the latest round of red flag military training exercises that were going on last week on ranges around the state.
It was definitely right in the middle of red flag.
Buffard said in an interview Monday that he thinks the Russians also were sending a message by conducting the sorties with only one IL-20 and not a Tu-95 Bear bomber that usually carries out the missions, often accompanied by a Russian jet fighter. He says those flights enable the Russians to gain useful intelligence, sometimes by just noting how the Americans respond.
All the aircraft that they send into an ADIZ is meant to invoke a response and a reaction for the purposes of being able to monitor that and see if they can learn from it.
Ott said in an interview Monday that there haven't been any Russian aircraft sorties since last week, but she declined to say whether there'd been any others earlier this year. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
The Anchorage School District plans to staff bus routes based on need as new drivers begin working. At a school board meeting last night, Superintendent Jarrett Bryant said the district will prioritize routes that serve low-income students and students who live farthest away from their schools. He said each new route will serve multiple schools.
There'll be a flurry of new schools that come online as we add routes, but our intent is all new bus drivers that come in, we're prioritizing those resources towards the families and communities and students with highest levels of need and the communities for which we have safety concerns about the route.
One of those communities will likely be Diamond Estates, a mobile home park on the east side of Anchorage. Parents and teachers told the board that some of the 330 students who live there attend school 8 miles away. Tara Devlin teaches English language learners at South High School and Golden View Middle School. She told the board that bus route suspensions will disproportionately impact her students that come from Diamond Estates.
The school closures and online learning showed us that a distinct disadvantage for the students in the neighborhood compared to their Southside and Girdwood peers because of the internet, limited English, food security, and the heavy responsibility on older students to take care of their siblings.
In a message to families today, Bryant said three new bus drivers will begin working next week. At the board meeting, he said more than a dozen newly hired drivers are currently training for their commercial driver's license, and seven others will start training next week. The district expects another 17 drivers to start on September 19th. Bryant said the Anchorage Assembly and Mayor Dave Bronson's office have offered support from the city. He also said district leaders have spoken with Governor Dunleavy, but did not provide further information. Well, a small village in Bristol Bay received a statewide award for their work promoting literacy and education. The community of about 70 residents has pursued big things from its little library. KDLG's Catherine Moncure reports that the award's recipients want to make their programs accessible to others throughout Bristol Bay.
In Igiagic, what started as a small community bookshelf in the early 1990s has grown into a full library. Today, it's housed in the school building and run by the Igiagic Tribal Council. The library isn't just a home for books. Its projects include a summer reading program, a bilingual UPIC, an English oral history project to document Native stories, a bilingual children's book, and an interactive story walk around the village. Earlier this summer, the village of Igiagic received the Contributions to Literacy in Alaska Award from the Alaska Center for the Book. The center is part of a nationwide network designated by the Library of Congress. The award recognizes individuals and groups that promote literacy throughout the state. Library Supervisor A.J. Gooden says this latest award gives them the energy to continue their efforts.
We're surprised and delighted, and it fuels the fire for going forward. You know, we know ourselves that it's a worthwhile endeavor, but it's also fun to have other people recognize it and enjoy it.
Academics from outside the state, including those from Harvard's Nation Building Program, have also come to Igiagic to study the village's history, literacy, and technology initiatives, like its hydrokinetic power system. The president of the Igiagic Village Council, Alexana Salmon, says having a library and a highly engaged community has given them agency in that research process.
This has brought in relationships with researchers in a way where our village controls the research happening, and we use the library as a forum to gather and have dialogue, conversations, or community feedback on some of the research being done.
Carol Sturgilewski, who oversees the Contributions to Literacy in Alaska Awards Committee, says recipients are often people who wouldn't get larger recognition otherwise.
And a lot of times it's people who haven't got a lot of recognition for what they're doing because they're doing it in a small way, and they're not in it for glory and or money or whatnot. And those are things we think should be rewarded.
The Alaska Center for the Book is always looking for nominations. More information can be found at alaskacenterforthebook.org. In Dillingham, I'm Catherine Moncure.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts, including Spotify now. We had reports tonight from Kavitha George and Liz Ruskin in Anchorage, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Sabine Pooks in Kenai, Kirsten Dobroth in Kodiak, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, and Catherine Moncure in Dillingham. Our audio engineer tonight is Ammon Swenson. Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil exploration and production and working to create economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
And by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.